Well, welcome everyone on a midsummer's day. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm co-director of the Africa program here at CSIS. I think many of you know our guest today, Pat Utomi, and many of you are familiar with some of the issues that he's going to talk about, and I hope we can turn this into a conversation, even though we have this very formal setting. It's meant to be informal. Pat Utomi, I think as many of you know, is a professor at the Lagos Business School. He had a brief foray into the political realm in the last presidential elections, but is now still very much engaged in a less formal way in the political arena. Pat has also been the author for us of a chapter in a recently published book on China in Africa, talking about China's role in Nigeria and kind of different perspectives within the government on China's role, and an expert in economics, and I think he'll talk a little bit about what he's working on now as well. Today he's going to be talking about the Niger Delta, possible way forward, the dynamics of the crisis and the current administration's response, what might be the way forward. And based on this presentation today, he also has a short piece that will be published on the CSIS online forum, which is available on our website, and which we're looking forward to getting up there after this presentation. Pat, it's always a pleasure to have you, and I think we'll talk for 30 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to questions and discussions. So welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. And, it's a great pleasure for me to be here again. Let me say that I am just going to basically try to introduce the subject of the crisis in the Niger Delta beyond criminality, beyond the resource curse, partly because I think that there is a tendency not to quite capture the undercurrents. There's a great deal of, if you will, misinformation, inadequate information that then leads to a response of the nature of a bunch of criminals running around the Niger Delta trying to make trouble. How do we get security to be at the level where we can contain that challenge? I'd like to say in starting that even though a lot of the conflicts in parts of Africa that are natural resource endowed can be traced to the struggle to control the resources, the so-called resource curse challenge, that in looking at the Niger Delta, one has to go back a little further, because some of the earliest problems with the Niger Delta came even before oil became really a factor in that area. Yes, oil was discovered in commercial quantities in 1956 in Loibiri, but before 1956, the peoples of the Niger Delta already were agitated about the coming self-government, essentially from the perspective of minority rights issues, the worry that in a Nigerian federation that was being really built on a tripod of ethnic nationality groups, a so-called dominant ethnic nationality groups, that somehow they were going to suffer significantly as minority peoples in the Niger Delta. And this led to the original agitations that, again, resulted in the Willings Commission set up already in colonial times to probe into the problems of the Niger Delta. And one of the major recommendations of the Willings Commission to help alleviate these fears was that a river basin, a Niger River Basin Development Authority be set up to ensure that the gains of independence, economic gains of it, would not be lost by those peoples because they didn't have power as dominant ethnic nationality groups. The roots of the distrust in Niger Delta, I think, go back to how well that authority exercised its mandate. As we all know, the authority did not... It started out okay, because when we talk about some of those palm plantations in the Niger Delta, I mean, those were some of the initial outcomes of the authority. But shortly after independence, very little attention was paid to the work of that authority. In fact, the great paradox is that a few years later, about 1980 or so, the federal government began to aggressively implement river basin development authority-led growth. The Shagari administration was particularly known for driving those river basin authorities. They created them all around the country. Benue-Wena River Basin Authority. Much of the agricultural development irrigation schemes that took place back in those days, the Bakalori projects, were a function of that effort. But the original basis for river basin development authorities, which was the agitation in the Niger Delta, somehow basically just faded into the horizon somewhere. And this began to build in the people of the Niger Delta a sense that they really did not matter, that they were being taken for granted. And the roots of the distrust that exists to date were sown back then. Of course, the first, if you will, militant expression of this that most people became sensitive to was the movement of an undergraduate at the University of Nigeria at the time, Isaac Adakaboro. I think just recently in the States there was a celebration of his day. And so part of the effort of the new militants is to, you know, capture the great myth of the kind of irredentism that was championed by Boro. In the main, I like to identify, if you will, seven factors that I think are driving the current state of despair in the Niger Delta. And they include the point I've just tried to make about minority rights, poor governance or bad governance generally in the country and particularly in that region, the law of crude oil stealing, and this really has a very, very broad perspective affecting so many different groups, and I'll talk to some of that. The death of the principles upon which the Nigerian Federation was founded, especially principles of fiscal federalism, the criminalization of politics, and that's something to that phrasing, criminalization of politics, which is really what has helped the growth or put fuel to the fire of the growth of the militant movements. The enclave nature of the oil economy and therefore the failure of trickle down. And then, of course, the half-hearted implementation of many initiatives to try and deal with this festering sore that's remained there. And after talking to these points as quickly as we can manage to, then I will look at this issue of the Delta as a security issue, and then some of the challenges, some of the responses, some policy responses, including the summit that has now failed, some of the efforts that some of the governors are making, and some of the groups that I am identified with, which includes the United Niger Delta Energy Development Strategy Initiative and the Niger Delta Economic Summit Group that is recently emerging as pointers to some of the things that could happen. Now, very quickly, to these factors driving this, the challenge of minority rights. One of the responses to the challenge of minority rights, which led to the original, if you will, recommendations of the Willings Commission, has been the creation of states. Many reasons drove the reason for the 12-state structure during the crisis that led to the Civil War and during the Civil War. But creation of states were seen as part of the solution to the problems of minority groupings. But part of what has come out of the state creation process is really the demise of competing ethnic communities. I think what Howard Wolpe and Robert Melson back in those days talked about in their writing, competitive communalism, if you will. What has happened is that as oil revenues have come on top of this fractioning, most federations grow by accretion. Nigeria is one of the few federations in the world that has grown by binary fission, literally, subdividing and subdividing. As the states have become less effective as organizing units for this competition between ethnic nationality groupings, what we have found is that the, permit me to talk about this, prebendal orientation of going to wait for a preband to be handed out from the center has compounded the challenge of creating wealth at the sub-national levels, and it's deepened the crisis of many of those areas. So it was thought to be a solution. Now, in my opinion, it's become really a classic iatrogenic policy choice. You know, the solution has created a greater disease than it intended to solve. Then the problem of governance. I don't think that we need to look for any great examples to show that quality of governance has deteriorated significantly in Nigeria. And the part of the effect we have seen, I think a classic example would be in the so-called Truth and Reconciliation a commission sittings now in River State. It just shows how the process of governance has broken down and the failure of government to address the needs of the people. About 3 years or so ago, I wrote this paper with Gareth Williams and a colleague on the political economy of growth in Nigeria for DFID. And the conclusion that we reached in that paper was that governance had failed so terribly in Nigeria, partly because people did not see a link between their delivering service to the people and their political fortunes. If the reason you became a governor or whatever it is position you aspired to was because some godfather or somebody else could do it and it didn't matter whether people voted for you or not, the need, the pressure to deliver was not there. And so you found that the political process prevented effective governance in the main in Nigeria. And this has gotten so bad that at the local government level, and in many ways at state levels in some cases, it's just a matter of going to the center, getting the allocation of that that it was the due of the state from the center, and the governor goes, and I'm not joking, goes straight to the foreign exchange counter and just exchanges a portion of the allocation and heads for Europe and wherever it is they take these monies to. And so you look at a state, most states, it's not, you know, but it's more glaring in the so-called oil-producing states, my home state of Delta. And you look at the kinds of amounts of money that have come into the coffers of the state government, and you drive around the place, and you're going, it's not possible. There's something wrong here. I can't relate this to that. But clearly, governance failed very badly, and it exacerbated the challenge in many of these areas that we're already complaining about, so many things. Then the law of crude oil stealing. I'm sure some of us may have been following recent revelations by the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation that it has spent enormous amounts of money to pacify the militant groups in the Niger Delta to make sure to safeguard oil pipelines. And of course, the militant groups are up in arms. Show us how much you gave us. So I define the law of crude oil stealing at a very broad level. First, there is the direct stealing, and Shell can give you all kinds of numbers about how much they're losing. Recently, some Filipinos and others were arrested who were part of a major organized process of stealing crude. Now, senior military people in Nigeria, senior politicians are known to be involved in this. In fact, a friend of ours who became head of government there's this great anecdote about how he asked to see what was going on. And they said to him, do you really want to see? He said, yes, I have to. I said, fine. So they sent to his office this mountain high pile of files on the subject. And he comes to, he sees it, he opens the first, he sees the names, he ties it, opens the second, sees, after a while, he ties the whole thing and calls the secretary and says, who left this thing on my table? He said, you asked for it. No, I don't want to see it. Take it away. Because he did not want to deal with the fact of coming to terms with who was involved in this. So now we've created a class of people who live extraordinary lifestyles and produce absolutely nothing. And they live off this rent system. So as they take from the top, I mean, the smaller criminal elements who want to get their own piece of the action, you even have international syndicate groups that are... So that compounds the problems of the Niger Delta. And some of these young men, whether they be criminals, whether they be people who are really politically active, who are angry at the way things are, they are fueled by this access to, quote-unquote, this easy resource. So managing that problem of stealing crude oil is critical to resolving the problem because it fuels it. Then there is, of course, the central issue here, which is what has been called resource control. In some ways, I am strangely connected to the genesis of this whole thing because at the first anniversary of the return to civil rule, the government of Delta State had this big lecture in Warri that I was the speaker at. And I had a brief from the governor about the subject. And out of it, this whole business of the so-called resource control took on a life of its own. But the subject is a very simple one, really. One of the, in my view, great things about the American experience is how the dream, the vision of the founding fathers continue to resonate in how Americans deal with issues. And it ensures that, you know, there's certainly a culture of how to deal with certain kinds of challenges. The founding fathers of Nigeria essentially were driven by the principle of subsidiarity. The fact that federating units would come together and that the center could be kept up with resources that flow from the subnational units. If they were natural resources, 50% of it went to the center. This is the very foundation of the Nigerian Federation. And so in the 60s, that was the principle on which the states and the federal government related. Convergence of two things, oil and military rule, changed the arithmetic, if you will. The military, not subject to constitutions, we had liberty to alter these arrangements as they saw fit, and they continued to alter it to the point where the sub-national units with the mineral resources like oil got less than 2%. Indeed, Kalu Idika Kalu, who was finance minister under the Babangida administration, at one presentation made the point that after all the monies that were deducted upfront by the federal government and you then got a percentage going to the states, in reality, it was less than 1% that went to many of the oil-producing states. But because a general who is the head of state sends out some colonel to administer some state, and the colonel is unable to say, wait a minute, this is what it's supposed to be, and that process, states' rights were disappearing and got to a point that has made the so-called resource control issue central to this discussion. But when you discuss the subject matter, we had a constitutional conference during the last years of the Obasanjo administration, and the people from the Niger Delta were saying, if we could only get 18%, the principle from the beginning was 50%, they were saying, if we could only get 18%, and they were shouted down by all kinds of people who thought they were unreasonable, they were greedy. But the fundamental principle was 50%. And I thought that it showed really a problem with the ability of the political class to engage on a matter that could ultimately be the undoing of the Nigerian Federation. But that issue remains, and it's a major part of this discussion. Then there's the criminalization of politics, as a friend of mine likes to call it. What does this really mean? To secure and hold political power, many of the political actors around the country, but for some reason, particularly around the Niger Delta, built private armies, gangs, thugs, whatever. Sometimes they armed them, and there's a lot of this coming out in the Truth and Reconciliation Committee's work in River State. These young men had access to a lot of money coming from these political godfathers, and they had arms. And so after elections are won, what do you do with armed people who are used to having a spare change? Well, they begin to become armies of their own. And this has been a factor in all of this, because you lose control over such people. The fact of enclave oil and the failure of trickle down. Oil is a very capital intensive enterprise. A lot of the human capital that's used is actually foreign. And in a sense, the oil industry can function. Somebody once joked that if you set Nigeria on fire, the oil industry may actually not know, because there was little connection between the oil industry and the rest of Nigeria. carried on within their world and paid their taxes or whatever to government in Abuja. In fact, I once made a serious point of this. In 1996, I was an interview with Richard Dowden at The Economist at the time, and I said, you know, in fact, it runs two ways. First of all, the oil industry may not even notice if Nigeria was on fire. The other part of it is, you know, if you gave all the oil in Nigeria to the soldiers who were in power and their politician friends, and they took it and went away, Nigeria would be so much better off for it. And Richard was naughty enough to report that and said, fair comment. In many ways, this nature of the industry has taken away from the positive impact in terms of job creation, the knock-on effects of economic activity in the Niger Delta. And what we then find is, of course, the negative impact in terms of what is a challenge of the environment and so on and so forth. So it makes people even more unhappy in the region. So we have to then develop some capacity for dealing with these problems. Then, of course, there's the half-hearted implementation of the many initiatives that have come since the Willings Commission to try and make sure that you deal with the anger and the pain in the region. We set up several organizations, most famous amongst them, one called OMPADEC, and the current one is the NDDC. But the general trend, again, in an economy that is significantly a rent economy, is that we set up these agencies ostensibly to improve the quality of life of people in the region, and some powerful people from Abuja who don't live in the region, who are not from the region, even if they're from the region, they don't live in the region, get notes and they get contracts, and the money works right out of the region, and no real progress takes place in the region. So you get people even more angry because they watch the news, they hear figures, huge amounts of money, quote-unquote, that are supposed to be for dealing with challenges in their environment, and they're still living in the 15th century. I think that you really need to live in the Niger Delta. Even as someone who comes from that part, traveling around the country as I campaigned 2 years ago, I was, you know, really, to say, shocked in some cases with the conditions, I mean, the quality of life of people who are looking at a platform, an oil platform just across. You know, you really have to live it to understand the pain. I was part of the think tank of Delta State. I was set up by the governor at the time, James Ibori, in 1999. And when we went, we tried to get material. Only one town in all of Ijoland in Delta State, Bomadi, was connected to the national grid, connected to power. So you can imagine how the crisis of trust will become deeper and deeper as they look at the environment in which they live. They don't believe the federal government. So what to do? The key, I think, is to build trust. How do we build trust? Personal effectiveness guru that I like to read very much, Stephen Covey, likes to make the point that, you know, you don't build trust by talking about, you do something. And it is in doing something and doing what you promise to do that you build up this cycle of trust. But all we've done is talk to the subject. We really have done very little. One of the reasons I opposed the summit that was proposed, that was to be chaired by my dear friend, Professor Gambari, and I kept saying to people, problem is not the person of Gambari. Some people who were opposed to the summit try to attack Gambari as a person, but I thought that was not the point. The point is the summit could only, in the context of the perception of the Nigerian way by people of Niger Delta, be an opportunity to keep them busy for another 3-4 years. They will talk through and they say, okay, it's election time now. You know, immediately after the election, we're going to be implementing what we promised, that, you know, and then after elections, and the same thing. They've gone through this several times. So why don't you just do something? Typical example, something that I promised on the campaign. What is so difficult as to do a major east-west highway? I don't know how many lanes, whatever it is, that runs across the Delta, linking it to Lagos. It's not just that it will open up many of these areas. It is also that it will help the prospecting of the oil companies. I have been told by a former managing director of the NNPC that the oil companies, in fact, offered a few years ago to help build such a highway. And the issue became, well, what will the federal government, how will the federal government, and the federal government said to the oil companies, okay, bring the money. I mean, you don't want to give money to the federal government of Nigeria to build something. And it never got done. So, if we started out saying, okay, hey, let's go do this highway that has so many things. Now people begin to say, okay, wait a minute, there's some seriousness here, something is intended, they're doing something. Then you begin to dialogue, to talk on the basis of some action that, but to just say, okay, let's talk again. People have had enough talking. And so you get these kinds of problems. So, then the question of the military response to all of this. Clearly, there's a security issue involved here. But in my view, the security issue begins by first trying to earn the trust of those people. The response of MEND and other militant groups to the British Prime Minister's indication at the last G8 meeting that he would be willing to support efforts to better secure the Niger Delta is a clear example of the fact that the military's response is not the way to go. You definitely need security. No government should lose sovereignty over a part of his country. And the truth of the matter, right now, the Nigerian government has lost significantly sovereignty over the Delta regions in Nigeria. And no government should do that. But you don't solve that by saying, okay, now we can get support from here and there, moving the troops. I don't think many people have easily won wars against guerrilla types, insurgents in Delta areas. I was not in the Mekong Delta, but I'm sure some people here may know a little better what we are dealing with here. And so more important here is engaging the people, building trust with the people. And when that is done, I think there is enough of a sense for the fact that the destiny of the Nigerian peoples are better served together. But it is not unlikely that there are people who are taking harder and harder positions. And they begin to rationalize it, in fact, by saying, well, the American intelligence community suggested a couple of years ago that Nigeria will not be around as an entity in 15 years' time. Maybe all of this is working towards that goal. I think that the forces that recognize that Nigeria is important for the future of the sub-region, both from a security point of view, from a development point of view, because I fully subscribe to the view of the flying geese phenomenon, that the resurgence of Southeast Asia was really a function of one person doing okay, the others coming and everybody flocking together. That region of the world, which needs revitalization, can perform well only when you get leaders providing, if you will, the spark for geese to flock down a path of progress. And we need to get the Nigeria question sorted out if we are going to get that sub-region make the progress that I think it deserves to make in the interest of the global community, not just because of energy, but general human solidarity and well-being. So I think I'll just stop there and we can go back and forth. Thank you.
Pat, thank you so much. Very comprehensive talk, and we'll open it up for questions now. What after this failure of the summit, what is kind of the plan B now? I mean, what is the thinking now of what's going to happen? That would be one question. Two, you know, I hear again and again, we know who's doing this, we know who's connected, we know in the military, and there's that big stack of files put on your friend's desk. Would there be utility if these are all known to get them out there in the public eye and kind of the name and shame approach? Who would do that, and would that perhaps put some pressure on? That's just to start, but we can turn to Peter Lewis and take a couple perhaps together.
Yeah, on the trust issue, Pat, I mean, a critical set of players are the fighters. And what we know about them or think we know about them is that there's about 50 or 60 camps, different commanders, not a clear political agenda, and so forth. How would you begin to tackle negotiations with the fighters? And what kinds of steps could be undertaken to engage some trust from that side? And then a second question is, what can be done about rogue governors, the Bores and Odiles and others of this world who are really hijacking any possibility of either injecting development or getting some kind of stuff?
Take one more right behind Peter. Yeah.
Hello. Dr. Yotumi, I really enjoyed your presentation. However, I would like to hear your perspective of linking some of the seeking entities to Washington, because from my experience in Nigeria, even though the governors are stealing and local people are stealing, it would seem as if monies are also being moved from Nigeria at the presidential level and into, we know they go into all sorts of developed countries' bank, and there is a big play in Washington too, which I won't go into here from my observation. But also, if it seems to me that if you're saying, if you do away with the rent-seeking economy, okay, shut down oil or take oil wherever you want to take it offshore, Nigeria will be a better place. But since we know that oil is there, energy is something that is making money for a lot of people around the world. Is there any sort of comprehensive strategy really to address the economic development in Nigeria and integrate the Delta Niger region? Are we saying that the leadership of the country has lost control of the region, that even with the programs, which some of them I'm familiar with, you know, that are in place, right, and are under implementation currently via the reform, that there's no linkage into that particular region to uplift the people? And, you know, some of the things you said, I really agree with it. You know, in terms of security alone is not an issue, right? These people are not criminals. There are historical factors there that needs to be addressed, and so on and so forth. So if you could address the other issues, I would really appreciate it.
Okay, so I'll take a couple of these and then we'll come back. The failure of the summit and what should be in place, we were involved in a series of meetings leading up to one that took place with the vice president, at which it was agreed to abandon the idea of the summit. And what was accepted, and I don't know that sometimes there's enough rigor on the side of the policymakers when these things come to them, was that there were enough, if you will, reports available on the Niger Delta that what was needed was to get a technical group together to work through those reports and essentially sell a blueprint for implementation the people. And people made points like, you know, I talk about NDDC supposed to do this, and people are looking out for NDDC to do something. And you look at the budget that NDDC has. In fact, one particular person made a point, former MD of NNPC from the region who was at this meeting, said, look, if you look at the budget from 3 or 4 years ago, there was almost as much money to build a road to Abeokuta, which is Obasanjo's hometown, which is on solid, dry, hard ground, as there was in the entire NNPC budget to build roads over swamps. He said, can there be a sincerity of purpose in this? So, anyway, the point is, this technical committee is supposed to, if it were, synthesize what is available and then get the government to begin to implement some of what recommendations they make. So that's supposed to be the alternative to this summit.
So a literature review instead of a summit.
In the manner of speaking, yes. But the people who review it will be essentially people picked from the various communities around the area so that ownership can accrue to them and they can really go forward. Name and shame, people on that. You know, I think international, really serious international pressure can help down that path. I think the nature of the Nigerian elite, power elite, narrow as it is, will probably make it difficult for an incumbent who doesn't have a great vision of how to build some kind of nation to make those kinds of decisions. Of course, it's going to be difficult for the person. So it has to come more or less in the manner of how the international community chases down a Milosevic or somebody of that nature, really. Interestingly, in 1996, I was spending some time in the Boston area on sabbatical, and I went to visit with editors of the Christian Science Monitor, because when I was in grad school back in the late 70s, I used to contribute to Christian Science Monitor. And we got to talking about all kinds of things going on in the world, and I talked about the future of an international criminal court and said that, in fact, I looked forward to a day where some heads of state could be brought to court, not just for the kind of genocide we talk about now, but for economic genocide against their people because of how they managed. And they said to me, even the idea of an international criminal court is so preposterous, not to talk of what you're... You know, a few years later, we had an international criminal court, and I'm still waiting for a time when we'll be able to take some people to a court for economic genocide against their own people. Pressure of that nature can lead to some possibilities in regard to the point you've raised, Jennifer. Trusts and the fighters, Peter, how do you tackle the negotiations with so many groups? It's in the nature of this thing. Once it takes a life of its own, that there will be all kinds of opportunities and all of that. Now, if you get the main people to commit, that's when you have a good army to take care of the gangs and the people who want to profit from. But very importantly, you need the heart of the people. Now, most of these groups are supported by, fed by all these old women that you think don't, when they come out from the creeks, somebody gives them food. You know? When you get to the hearts of those old women, not so old necessarily, but those women, and they know that something is being done for their general well-being, I think they will begin to say to those boys, hey, okay. That's why The first battle has to be the hearts of the people. Then, once you get to the people who are politically motivated in engaging militarily will come with them, and then you can deal with the criminal elements that are just taking advantage of the situation. Rogue governors. You know, just some... just before I came here, one of your former colleagues came to visit with me, a Nigerian professor here in Washington, and he said, you know, what is most painful about the situation in Nigeria is that these rogue governors are going around, you know, feeling like, hey, you see, we are above the law. Nothing can happen to us. And that really is the biggest feeling of this moment, that they don't have to get everybody. The corruption was so pervasive and all of that. But 2-3 of the very worst cases needed to have become examples. But right now, the impression is we'll get away with anything. So, in fact, they are deciding what will happen next in Nigerian politics right now, these so-called rogue governors. And that is the biggest, you know, failing, in my view, of the moment. Money is being moved from Nigeria, an economic development strategy. Now, one of the things that I find some hope in, and I was mentioning this to Jennifer as we walked down here, and she was asking what's really at the root of it. You know, a few of the current governors are making some sort of effort. Next week, I'll be chairing an initiative of the River State Government to develop a strategy for job creation, youth empowerment in the state. And I mentioned that a few seem to be making the effort, and I said, what's the reason? And I think it was actually Steve who said, what do you think is responsible for this? And I said, you know, I suspect that it is the fact that the crisis of legitimacy is so deep that a few of them are trying to end their wings, and they are beginning to be, you know, what was the right thing to do so that we can. I know one of the governors, some reason I shouldn't mention his name, but said to me, you know, if I knew this country was as complex and as, use his word, awful as this, I would never have sought office. But he's there, and he's trying to do something. Maybe this struggle to build some legitimacy will help. In terms of economic strategies, Nigeria is not in want of ideas of how to move forward. But many years ago, I referred to... somebody else suggested the term, and I've used it repeatedly since then, the Nigerian economy as a recursive economy. You know, some great ideas, and you're making progress, and some, because of institutional weaknesses, and this is my explanation, you go into a retreat. You two steps forwards, three steps backwards, and this kind of movement. But what we are in right now is a bit of that recursive mode. And if I use the example of somebody speaking at one of those sessions 2-3 weeks ago in Lagos, he said, you know, I used to write a column saying the last 1 year the country has been stagnated, we've not been making progress, we don't have a direction. But I'm ready to take that back. I think I was wrong. Country was not stagnated. There was momentum. There was a clear direction. The only problem is we're going the other way. this gentleman who made this point then said, and I think that's what's important here, it's going to be clear very soon that the direction we're traveling is not sustainable. And so there will be a turnaround. I have no worries about that. I'm sure there will be a turnaround. But the question, what will be the cost of having gone in the other direction? So I think that all these great ideas about how to reform the economy, how to make progress, which are already on the table, will gain traction again. Unfortunately, in this recursive mode, we may have lost a bit of a great opportunity. You know, I look at what some of the Middle East countries are doing with current oil prices in terms of how they're looking at their future. You know, I'm saddened that we're missing this window.
Get a little bit more into. I'm sorry, Pat. I want to follow up on Peter's question and get a little bit more into sequencing, because some of the development projects that people start or government starts also get attacked by the militants. So if you start a big road project, how do you know that it won't be attacked? How do you get buy-in so that you can proceed on these projects? And what is it going to take to buy them in? You say get at the sort of grassroots support for these groups, but that takes a little while, too. So it's a sequencing of showing evidence on the one hand, but also having gotten the groups in on the other that I think is a frustrating part of this.
I have a fundamental issue. And you identified it in the comments that you made. And I'd like to preface my fundamental issue by telling just a two-sentence story. You remember Ambrose Ali? He was governor of then Bendel State. He was one of those jailed as a result of some misappropriation of government funds by the military. His people in Ekpoma, that's his home village, said, tell us how much he stole and we'll return the money, just release him from prison. So that told me there is no sense of accountability either on the part of the people or on the part of those who are governed. How do we break this disconnect between the governors and the governed? Because nobody is asking questions, or pretty small group of people are asking questions and not being listened to. I don't contribute to anybody's campaign funds, so he doesn't owe me anything. He doesn't, when he gets into office, he doesn't believe that he owes me anything. How do we break that so that people who occupy positions in government know that it doesn't belong to them? They're holding it in trust for the people. What do we need to do?
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. Is some of this on the internet so that the people can see what's going on and discuss it over the internet?
My name is Ogi Okoye with the National Endowment for Democracy. I think you made a very important point when you said we should try to get to the heart of the people to solve the problem. And traveling around in the Niger Delta area and working with nonprofit organizations over there, we find out that a lot of the nonprofit groups that work there, they know the militants in their community. They went to schools with these people. But they've been able to, there's some progress in the little communities where they're working. But whenever these national summits are called, you never see these nonprofit organizations there. You never see these people at the local grassroots level there. Is there any attempt to try and bring these people to the table to discuss as well? And then you also talk about small arms. This is a very broad subject when it comes into small arms in Nigeria, but is there anything the Nigerian government is doing to at least monitor the number of small arms that comes into that region every year?
Princeton, the question of sequencing, as you have indicated, is very, very important. And in some ways it goes to the last point raised here. We have been making presentations lately on how you can involve a very broad spectrum of stakeholders, including those very, very grassroots types, in such an initiative. Let's take doing this highway. You can involve so many different groups. As you know, one of the things that we've proposed as part of this thing that we're going to suggest to the River State government in next week, that you do town hall meetings around the area. So to prepare the people generally. Okay, what are the issues? Everybody, so many people have different issues, and when you then collate what comes out of this, and you come back next time and say, now, part of our intervention is, now we're going to do this highway across this. In doing this highway, there are these possibilities that will involve literally all of those stakeholders in some way. Even some of those boys with arms would like some jobs on that project and some, you know. But you involve all critical stakeholders in some way. This is, I mean this differently, but one of the ways I've expressed this is bribed people out of, that is, I mean, it's like, Nigeria, you know, you can't fix the railroads because the trailer drivers or the trailer owners have an interest in preventing it, or, you know, so make them own the railroads, you know, literally offer them an incentive to move on to the next best thing to, and that's the way that we see this. We can get all of the stakeholders, offer them an incentive to profit from this right way of going forward. And the way that we have thought through it for now is, let's begin with these town hall meetings at which we agree what the main problems are and take it to the implementation of specific ideas and how everybody is involved in that process of implementing these ideas. Shall I sympathize? I know your frustration. But you see, what came out of the Ambrose Ali and several experiences of that nature, wasn't new. Peter Ake became famous as a Nigerian political science for something he didn't, according to, give extraordinary thought to, any the so-called two publics idea. You know, when you steal from the coffers of your local community development organization, that is a high crime. You take from the coffers of the federal government of Nigeria, well, you are getting your share of what. So we've got to deal with that challenge of two publics. However, I think that education will play a critical part in this. And very, very importantly, a real democracy. As much as we pretend we don't have a democracy in Nigeria, let's be very frank here, where people can see a relation, you know, some connect between that their action and the outcome of the elections. And I think it's possible for all of us. And I think sometimes you and I don't do enough. I've gotten into a lot of trouble from people who sit in New York and Minnesota and write all kinds of stuff, and they sit here in the comfort of American suburbia. Hey, come and risk your life as I have done. I say that I have the right to talk down at people because I've brought out my head, stuck my head out, put my life on the line several times. Abacha tried to kill me, and it's happened again since. So I have the right to talk down at somebody who just sits somewhere and pontificates. Anyway, Nigerians will have to build the nation, and we have to make sacrifices for that to happen. And that includes people. I like to say that we don't have a problem-solving mentality in Nigeria. If a Nigerian sees potholes around the place, and he begins to go to church to pray that he finds money to buy a four-wheel drive so that instead of how we can fix the problem. So, how about you contributing money to my campaign? That will help. So, is this on the internet? There's plenty of stuff on this on the internet. Maybe some of those sites. I was going to mention that besides Undeads, which has its own site, and we were very engaged in these matters. There's a new initiative. We just had our first meeting 2 weeks ago. It's Niger Delta Economic Development Group. It includes some former MDs of NNDC, some politically active academic types, former military types, to look at how we can create an economic movement for the Niger Delta. And I think that very soon it should be up also on the net, and access to that kind of information should help. Now, the last question, which I think I did already engage Oge's question about those NGOs, those people at the grassroots, is something about the nature of elite engagement in Nigeria that assumes that problems are dealt with only when the big men get together. Is that part of the culture of the big man? But I think that we must engage people at those levels. They must enter the process if we're to make progress.
Thank you. John Miller with Raytheon Company. And if you spend some time in Boston, you know that Raytheon is a defense and commercial electronics company, reasonably large, looking to grow the business, realizes that Nigeria could be a market, but the picture you painted today is not one that would be very attractive to American business. What advice would you give to American businessmen who want to do business in Nigeria? And secondly, if I could, would you comment on what role you might see for the Africa Command that's going to be stood up here in the United States, actually stood up in Stuttgart, Germany, on 1 October?
Thank you very much. Roman Spock from National Democratic Institute. How would you assess and how do you view the role of the National Assembly in the process of bringing peace to the Delta? And also, what is your current assessment of the probes that the National Assembly has initiated and the latest against the NNPC? Thank you.
Well, I would hope that nothing I said today will discourage you from investing in Nigeria. Indeed, actually, it's important to solve problems that we get to the heart of the challenges. But I think that Nigeria is pretty decent territory to do business beyond the violence, the type of things that's in the media, the criminality and all of that, is a very, very small part of my real problem is the crisis of values. For me, values shape human progress. And part of what has happened with oil and coal is there's been really a collapse of culture. And the real charge of leadership is to rebuild culture in Nigeria. Nigeria is a country of very entrepreneurial people. But it's clearly work in progress to get some things right. But businesses that have had the courage, if you will, to make the right choices have done very well in Nigeria. I'd like to give you a number of examples. When Nigeria decided finally to open up its telecom space, I mean, someone like me had written for years about it. My favorite example was just the year that I spent in Boston making phone calls to Nigeria very frequently and getting a call from Sprint one morning. And he says, "Well, you notice you make a lot of calls to Nigeria," and I got very defensive. "And so, yes, didn't I pay my bills?" I said, no, because you make so many calls. We want to give you a 50% discount on your rate. And I thought, oh, this is September. Father Christmas is coming early. What's going on? Yeah. And after that, I said to myself, "Dummy, you came here to write a book on competition and strategy, and you can't see competition. You can't see strategy coming at you. This is really it at play." And I wrote stuff about how telecom monopoly in Nigeria will just die. At that time, the Iridium project had prospects. I thought about it. I said, "Oh, someday people are going to have phones with U.S. numbers and ignore the Nigerian telecoms. He's going to die. Let's do something. Let's sell it." I was ignored for a long time, and eventually when we decided to sell it or to do something about it, we opened up the GSM, the mobile telephony space. Most of the major players around the world thought, "Oh, Nigeria, you know, problematic place." So some small company from South Africa, some Zimbabwe types in South Africa, and some. Now, everybody's trying to get in the market because it has just transformed the South African player that came in into a much bigger player. And we've seen that happen in a couple of other sectors. So I think that, in fact, business is part of the solution. As business makes the right choice and moves in, we begin to recreate a middle class that further stabilizes Nigeria and makes for more progress. And the ultimate beneficiary is the business that made that opportunity come about in the very first place. So, want to come to Nigeria any day? Call me. I'll give you free advice. This consultant is willing to offer his free. The Africa Command, I think that there is a place for ensuring security around the world. And if the command works well with regional players, it would probably be in the interest of everybody. But, of course, it's important to be sensitive to whatever the local, quote-unquote, sensitivities might be in terms of how things are structured and all of that. But I think that there is a place for stabilizing regions of the world, and an Africa High Command or Command can clearly play a role in that. National Assembly and peace in the Niger Delta. I don't know. Some people find the role of National Assembly useful in setting the agenda. Some people are not happy with what seems to be a lot of motion with no movement in terms of the activities of National Assembly. I personally think that we should not have National Assembly that we have. I have argued for years for a citizen legislature in which you put together a group of very serious professionals for a few weeks in a year to pass laws for the governing of the country. I think National Assembly costs Nigeria too much and achieves very little. And my position on those probes have been borne out. Again, much of the attack I got from the internet warriors in the United States was that I said, look, the failure of the power sector, because everybody was kill them, catch them, they're all thieves. And I said, they may be thieves, and I think you can go after the thieves, but what's more important here is that it was collapse of project management capacity. I mean, spend billions of dollars importing generators that are sitting at the ports, and we don't have roads to take them to where they're supposed to be located. This is just project management failure. But some people couldn't think past those. And part of the role that the National Assembly plays in heightening that kind of not well thought through position on things is what we're dealing with in that. Where does the Delta sit as priority at this moment? I am not sure that the Delta issue was well thought through by the administration as they came to power. I beg to be forgiven here, but I have made a point, it says in the, out there in newspapers, that the seven-point agenda was just a glittering generality offered at a campaign. You know, the way I was taught about goals is that they've got to be smart, as they say. It's got to be very specific. You know, it's got to be really something that is tangible, we can hold on to. It's got to be measurable. And I say, okay, Niger Delta. Yeah, what do you want to achieve in Niger Delta? Nobody can tell me anything. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, you need to... It means Niger Delta is not really a priority. It's just a good thing to talk about. It's not that they don't think it's important, but I have not seen definitive action that suggests that, hey, this thing is top priority. Unfortunately, I think that at the moment it's unclear what the priorities are. So maybe when they become clearer, Niger Delta might be one of those there.
Let's have just two more. Do the gentleman in the back.
My name is Kobe Naidu, and I work with De Beers. And following up on the question by the gentleman from Raytheon, I do agree that business is part of the solution. But in a place like the Delta, I'd like to hear your thoughts on how business goes about getting that social license to operate, to build the trust you talk about, and also be an active partner in the actual development. And we've learned some things over the year as a company, but then I'd like to hear your thoughts on the matter. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Sure. We have more. Okay.
The gentleman there and then the lady here.
The militants have become increasingly brazen lately, going out into the Gulf of Guinea. We've seen 40 miles, 60 miles, and up to some 85 miles. And it's been postulated in the past, what would happen if European nations, and most of the oil that is taken from there is going to Europe, what would happen if they unilaterally went and protected their own platforms and their own lines of communication, much the way that the United States did in Kuwait some 20 years ago? Would Nigeria tolerate that? Could Nigeria really do anything about it since it's outside the 12-mile limit? And would it add to the stability and creation of stability that you seek there if the European nations, the colonial powers, as it were, returned to Africa to protect the benefit of the bargain that they negotiated for?
I don't know if that would go over well. And then the lady here.
Okay, I forgot my question. Anyway, I probably will make a comment. It may turn out into a question. You know, you touched upon the whole project management, lack of project management and proper planning in Nigeria. And if you take that to the national level, I think that's one of the real problems in Nigeria. And I'm not saying it to say that Nigerians don't have wonderful skills, because they do. I believe that, and for me, I love democracy, but I also believe that a two-term government will have no real effect in Nigeria, because Nigeria seemed to me, and I hate to use terms like white elephant on every level when it comes on to government, bureaucracy, and many other things. I've worked there. I've lived there for 7 years of my life. And I used to be a special advisor with the government of Nigeria. I've lived from rural north to south, that sort of thing. And I feel that my experience has been there is no long-term planning, because politics and money goes together, and if people are not making money today, they don't care about tomorrow. And I oftentimes tell my friends from Nigeria that the woman who eats her own children is the worst mother. Okay, so I think that's the biggest problem. Looking even at the other countries coming in now to benefit from Nigeria's resources, such as China and India, they all have their coherent plan for 20, 50 years, and Nigerians are not negotiating in the best interest of their people for tomorrow. And it didn't start it today. It started, we know how long ago, and it's, you know, it continued through the oil economy and so on and so forth. And until we sit down and we're serious as people who have integrity and self-esteem, we're getting nowhere.
Thank you. David has a question.
I have the power of the microphone. Dr. Otome, can you address how your views on the EFCC, since Nuhu Ribadu was sent away for his year-long training program? Is this an institution that has lost momentum and credibility, or can it be moved forward?
Great. Just a small question.
That's a very small question. Okay. We're done? Yeah. Okay. Business has the solution. You know, there's so many ways that business can make a difference. I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was sitting at the business school, and school seems to be a magnet of sorts, because all kinds of things come at you. I got a call from people from Shell, and they said, you know, there is this initiative we're thinking of implementing. You know, we actually have it running in South Africa, in the UK. It's called LiveWire. And I said, oh, really? And they bring me all these documents this high from the ground again. On this program, I said, I'm reading through it. And then suddenly they disappeared. They need this more here than in South Africa and in the UK. I know they implemented something eventually, but the point I'm trying to to make here is that corporate social responsibility beyond something to just show because, you know, you want people to know that you're doing something, seen as serious self-interest, taking a long-term perspective, will do so much more than just running around. Because I think that the LifeWire program is a classic of the kind that I would think would make a great difference in the Niger Delta. Creating entrepreneurs of young people. One of the problems in Niger Delta with jobs in the oil and gas business for the indigenous is, well, the people don't have any skills. You really can hire them. Yeah. But we go to do welding in Bahrain. You know, when I was in grad school here a little while ago, we saw the Malaysians literally move people in 747s, and they all came and sat in classrooms here, and they moved them back, and those people played the roles that they played. I'm not sure why it is so difficult for Shola, you or Shell, everybody, get 200 people from the Niger Delta, put them in some bus them to Aberdeen, let them learn how to weld, bring them back. It's your self-interest here. It's not just being nice. So business can make a great difference if it gets the strategy right. I can talk about that some, but yes, it can. Militants are getting more brazen. That is true. Should unilateral action be taken to send the 5th Fleet or the 2nd Fleet or something to go into? I think that the informal arrangements, collaborating with local law enforcement, would probably go down much better than some new Berlin conference. You know, the partition of Africa, this is von Bismarck back in, you know. I think that you would probably excite people who didn't even care about such things into going, so maybe it needs to be managed differently than that. I also think that we need something more fundamental than a military kind of solution. You won't sustain it. There'll be all kinds of incidents, there'll be problems. Then they get more hardened. And after a while, it won't be, oh, these militants now, we'll be calling them terrorists because they're going to be sending a boat loaded with bombs to go and crash into the aircraft carrier that you have, you know. But yes, collaboration, you know, to provide security is not a bad idea. But it should be managed properly because there are sensitivities to these kinds of things. The women who eat their own children, I couldn't agree with you anymore. You are singing my song. This is what my whole career has been about, saying the things that you've been saying. And you know, I can only say that tenacity is at the heart of what makes for change take place. We'll keep singing that song. Hopefully you get to people one at a time. There's too much believing that if you can somehow take care of your own small space, that you are okay, but you are not okay. Because, you know, you locate your haven in the middle of this darkness called hell. One day it will get to you. EFCC, since Ribadu. David, you do cut the question, don't you? I believe in institutions, not individuals. Part of my problem with the Obasanjo era is that he tried to celebrate individuals rather than build institutions. We didn't do enough to build institutions. However, people facilitate the process of institution building. my personal view, which is widely known, is that I think it was a big mistake sending Ribadu off. But no, so he's gone. Question is, how does the system put enough pressure on his successors to work in the interest of advancing the common good? They've done a few things, but they're, you know, people are watching them. There's a low level of trust in their motives. But they have tried to do a few things. But they will really prove themselves if two or three of these rogue governors are in jail. That's really what the only thing that can get them their reputation back. So, are we really a country? You know, Shala, the view that I take is that all modern states, all modern come out of a patchwork of people coming from all kinds of places. The challenge is for you and I to work at it, recognizing that we advance a greater self-interest in our coming together. There are those who would like to see a fractious process that leads to smaller units. When you get the smaller units, by the time you get the Oduduwa nation, you will then get a quarrel between your yours and these, and you will eventually get it will come down to your village. A modern nation state bring all of us together if we just look at how in working together there's a bigger cake baked for all. I think it will work out well. Thank you.
Pat, thank you so much for the talk and for answering all those varied questions. And thank you all for coming. And again, you're always welcome here, and we look forward to seeing you again very soon. As I said, Pat's piece in the report on China's role in Africa is up on our website, and we have copies if any of you are interested as well. Anyway, please join me in thanking Professor Thomas.